From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. He had Motown's first big hit and dozens more. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Smokey Robinson. He has a new CD of jazz and pop standards. Now if there's a smile. After our interview with Smokey Robinson, David Bianculli will review Spike Lee's new HBO documentary about Hurricane Katrina. Really, I'm sad. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Smokey Robinson, one of the greatest soul singers ever and one of the most important figures in the development of Motown Records. He had the label's first big hit, Shop Around, which he followed with many more hits, including You've Really Got a Hold on Me, Mickey's Monkey, Ooh Baby Baby, The Tracks of My Tears, and I Second That Emotion. In addition to writing and producing most of his own records, Smokey Robinson also wrote for other Motown acts like The Temptations, The Marvelettes, Marvin Gaye, and Mary Wells. From 1961 until 88, Robinson was a vice president of Motown. Now he has a new CD called Timeless Love, featuring jazz and pop standards like Love Is Here to Stay, I've Got You Under My Skin, and I'm in the Mood for Love.
I'm in the mood for love, simply because you're near me. Funny, but when you're near me, I'm in the mood for love. Heaven is in your eyes.
That's Smokey Robinson from his new CD, Timeless Love. Smokey Robinson, what a real pleasure to have you on Fresh Air. Now, I read you quoted as saying that when you were a kid, instead of spending your money on candy, that you'd save your money for Hit Parade magazine. What was in the magazine that you loved?
Songs. I've always loved music and songs and songwriters. And whenever I would buy records, I would look to see who wrote the songs. And so I would spend my money to buy Your Hit Parade magazine because it had all the latest songs in there. Not until I became a professional songwriter myself and saw my songs in some of those magazines did I realize a lot of times they have the lyrics wrong. But, yeah, I used to do that.
So you were, I mean, when I was young, I don't think I was very aware of songwriters. I was aware of like the singers. But so when you were young, you knew that songs were written by people and you were interested
yes.
in who those people were.
Yes, I was. And see, that's what I'm talking about. See, you're right in line with what I'm talking about, Terry, because most people do that. Most people, their concentration and their focus is on the artist. But in those days when these songs were written, the focus was on the song, man. Somebody, you know, like the Irving Berlin wrote a hit song and all the artists jumped on it to sing it. And that's when these songs were written. So, but you're right with everybody else because most people do that.
So, when you were a kid, did you try writing songs in the style of Irving Berlin and the Gershwins and Rodgers and Hart?
You know what, honey? I just tried writing songs. I don't know who I was emulating. more than likely it was them because I always tried writing songs. The first song that I ever wrote where anybody other than me heard it was a song when I was 6 years old. I had this class called Auditorium at Dwyer Elementary in Detroit. And we would do plays and have little stage shows and stuff like that in this particular class. And we were doing a play. And the play was, the focus of the play was Uncle Remus. And Uncle Remus is a fabled old folklore guy, old black guy, who told tales to the kids about how the animals got to be how they are, how the leopard got the spots, how the pig got the curly tail, why the monkey swings from a tree, and all that. And so I was portraying Uncle Remus in this little play that we were having. And my auditorium teacher had this little melody that she played at the beginning of the show and the end of the show. And I asked her if I could write some words to it, and she allowed me to do so. So I've been trying to write songs all my life.
What were the lyrics you wrote?
Just hello, little children, hello, little children, hello, little children, we're going to have a play. And then we did the play. And then at the end of it, good night, little children, good night, little children, good night, little children, it's time to go to bed. And so that was it. That was a hit, man.
Who knew? Well, that's so great. Well, we were talking about your love of standards, but when you started singing with your own vocal groups, with your friends, what were you singing?
Oh, I was writing songs then. In fact, I'll tell you a little story about that. But we sang what was currently popular by the groups and the people we were listening to and the people that grew up. When I started to buy my records, of course, I was buying the popular people then. My number one singing idol was Jackie Wilson, which was how I actually met Berry Gordy. Because the group that turned out to be the Miracles and I went for an audition for Jackie Wilson's managers in Detroit. And at that time, Berry Gordy had written all of the hit songs that Jackie Wilson had out. And Berry happened to be at that audition. And rather than us singing songs that were currently popular by other people, we sang about five songs that I had written. And so Jackie Wilson's managers rejected us. They told us we would never make it because we had a guy singing lead high and there was a girl in our group. And there was already the Platters, who were very, very, very popular at that time. And so they had a guy singing high and a girl in the group. And so we would never make it because of the Platters. And Berry Gordy happened to be at that audition. And he was impressed because he had never heard any of the songs that we sang. So he came outside afterwards. He was there to turn in some new songs to Jackie Wilson. And he asked where we got the songs. And I told him I'd written them and so on and so forth. And he asked me if I had some more songs, which was a mistake on his part because I had 100 songs in a notebook that I had with me. And I sang about 20 of them for Berry that day. And he just critiqued them for me. And I told him that I had all of his music because I had all of Jackie Wilson's music and some of the other songs that he had written for Etta James and a couple groups and stuff like that. And we struck up a relationship. And about a year or so after that, man, we started Motown. And so that was a fabulous time of my life.
So when he critiqued your songs after you sang a bunch for him, what did he say?
Well, you know, Terry, I could always rhyme. From the time I was a little kid, I could always rhyme stuff. But my songs at that time didn't complete an idea. I would have a great rhymed up first verse, but it had nothing to do with the second verse, which was rhymed up really good. He made me know that I would have three or four songs in one song. And he just taught me basically how to construct a song and how to make a song one idea that carries from the beginning to the end, and the beginning and the middle and the ending all tie in together to give a person one complete idea, and how to construct my songs.
Would you be willing to quote one of the songs that you now realize didn't work?
That I now realize did not work?
Yes.
You mean that we sang that day?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
I don't remember, honey. I do remember the two that we sang, which were the most well-constructed ones that we sang that day, and one of them was called My Mama Done Told Me, and that became the flip side of our first recording, which was a song called Got a Job, and it was an answer to a group called The Silhouettes had a record called Get a Job, which was number one in the world at that time, and so I wrote an answer song to it called Got a Job, and so those were the two songs that really made sense that we recorded.
Yeah, Get a Job had the yip 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 yip, yeah, boom, 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 get a job. Did you have that in the answer song?
No, we didn't have the yip 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 yip, mum 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 mum. But at the end of our verses, our bass singer sing, got a job. So it was kind of like a takeoff on it.
My guest is Smokey Robinson. He has a new CD of standards called Timeless Love. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Smokey Robinson. He sings standards on his new CD, Timeless Love. When we left off, we were talking about how he first met and auditioned for Motown's founder, Berry Gordy. you and Berry Gordy co-wrote Got a Job, and then he wrote your first big hit, right, which was Shop Around.
No, he did not.
No, he did not write that.
It.
You wrote it.
Yeah.
Why did I
yes.
think he wrote it? Did he take
credit? I don't know
that?
Why you
did
thought
I just
that.
Read that wrong?
No.
I'm taking credit away from you.
No. What happened with Shop Around was the fact that we had a big hit on a guy named Barrett Strong, Money, That's What I Want. And Barry had, we had just started Motown, basically. You know, we had a few hits. But Barry wanted me to write an album for Barrett. So Shop Around was one of the songs that I wrote for that particular album. I was going to record it on Barrett Strong. And I was very excited because a lot of times songs just flow out. Shop Around took me about 20 minutes at the most to write. Some songs take longer to write. For instance, Cruisin', one of my hits that I did later on with my guitar player, took me 5 years to write a song for that particular music that he had come up with. But Shop Around had flowed out. In about 20 minutes, I had it. So I went to Barry's office and I told him, I said, hey, man, I have got a great song for Barrett for his next record. And he said, you have? He said, let me hear it. So we go down into the studio at the piano, and I play Shop Around, and I sing it for him. And he got very excited about it. So he said, move over, man, because I want to change these chords right here. And so on, which is why his name would be on the particular song on Shop Around. And he didn't want to put his name on it, but I insisted that he did because we worked on it for an hour or two there. And after we got through working on it, he said, I want you to sing this song. So I said, no, man, I wrote this song for Barrett. So we went through that for 5 minutes. No, you sing it. No, I wrote it for Barrett. No, you sing it. So finally he said, well, you just go into the studio and record this song and on You and the Miracles, and we'll see what happens. So I did. And when I sang it, when I had written it, it was like a little slower and bluesy. And so I recorded it on The Miracles and Me, and it came out. And it had been out for about 2 weeks, and it was doing fair. And Barry called me one morning at about 3 o'clock in the morning and said, hey, man, I want you to get the group and come to the studio because I've already called all the musicians, and I want you to come to the studio. I'm going to re-record Shop Around. I'm going to change the beat, and it's going to number one. So to make a long story short, I did. I called the group, and we went to the studio, and everybody showed up with the exception of the piano player. So Barry is playing the piano on Shop Around, and we re-recorded it in his version of it, which was the one that went to number one.
Yeah, it's a great story because it was really too late. You know, the record was out. It was already getting played on the radio.
Yeah,
and then
well,
Barry Gordy decides,
a lot at Motown.
No, we're going to redo that. I mean, it was like too late, and he did it anyways, and he was right.
No. You know, Terry, it's never too late because we've done that a few times at Motown, man.
What else did you do it with?
The very first Motown national record ever was a song on The Miracles of Me called Way Over There. And it was the same thing. I recorded it. It was doing great locally because we were just a local company at that time. And so Barry heard it, say, I love this song. So we went and recorded it again and put violins on it and all that because the Drifters had come out with their songs, and all their songs had violins. And so they were the first group, R&B group, to ever come out, and violins were predominant in their songs. So we wanted to re-record it with violins. And so we did. And then we released it nationally, which that was our first national release on Motown.
So when Barry Gordy called you in the middle of the night and said, we're going to do it over, it's too slow, were you insulted?
No, I was not insulted. I just said, man, are you crazy? He said, no, I might be, but this is what we're going to do. The first thing he said to me was, a smoke? I said, yeah, man. He said, this is Barry. I said, no, man, I recognize your voice. He said, what are you doing? I said, what am I doing? I said, I'm asleep. He said, well, I can't sleep. I said, I can see that. He said, Shop Around is driving me crazy, man. He said, I can't get it out of my mind, and I want to change the beat, so you get the group and come to the studio, and I've called the musicians, and we're going to re-record it. So that's what we did.
Well, I guess we'd better hear it. This is Shop Around, Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, recorded in 1960.
All right.
When I became of age, my mother called me to her side. She said, son, you're growing up now. Pretty soon you'll take a bride. And then she said, just because you become a young man now, there's still some things that you don't understand now. Before you ask some girl for a hand now, keep your freedom for as long as you can now. My mama told me, you better shop around. Tell them that you're
shop around.
Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, and Smokey Robinson has a new CD of standards, and it's called Timeless Love. Did your mother ever tell you to shop around?
No, I kind of lied on her with that song.
I bet you didn't mind.
Yeah, I didn't mind. No, she didn't mind either. No, unfortunately, I lost my mom when I was 10, you know, but I know she heard it anyway. Wherever she is, she heard that. But that was it. 3 o'clock in the morning, folks. That was what came out at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Now, the story goes that you suggested to Berry Gordy that he start his own record company, and that's how he started at Tamla, which eventually transformed into Motown. Did you suggest that? And if so, why?
Yeah, I did, because in the beginning, when we first got with Berry, he was, like I said, he was a songwriter and a producer, and he would produce records on the Miracles and Me and his other artists, and put them with other record companies, and nobody was paying us. I mean, it was back in those days, you know, if you didn't have four or five hits in a row, nobody paid you. They didn't even think about paying you. They just didn't pay you. So people were not paying us. So I just told him we might as well take a chance ourselves, because, you know, we might as well, if we're going to not make any money, we might as well not make any money with our own stuff. And so that's why we started Motown, so people could get paid.
And did you start doing anything different in the studio when it was really your own operation?
No, we just wanted to make good music. The first day of Motown, there were five of us there. There was Berry Gordy plus four other people. And we were there, and Berry said, "We are not going to make black music. We're going to make music. We're going to make music for everybody. We're going to make music that everybody can enjoy. We're going to make music with some great beats and some great songs." And that's what we set out to do. And thank God that's what we did.
And Shop Around was like the first big hit for
Yeah,
Motown,
it was the first million seller.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to move on to another big hit for you, which is You Really Got a Hold on Me from 1962. And this is something you wrote and produced. Is there a story behind the song?
Yeah, Sam Cooke, who turned out to be one of my friends, was my number two singing idol. I told you Jackie Wilson was my number one singing idol as a kid growing up. And Sam Cooke was my number two singing idol. And Sam Cooke had out a record called Bring It On Home to Me, which was one of those slow, bluesy kind of songs. In fact, doing the second vocal on him, with him on that particular song was Lou Rawls. And it was like one of those slow, bluesy kind of songs. It was a really big hit. So I wanted to write a song like Bring It On Home to Me. So I had gone, I was vice president of Motown at the time, and I had gone to New York to make a deal with a publishing company there. And we were going to, you know, intertwine some of our songs with their songs and some of their songs with our songs and what have you, and make a publishing deal. So I'd gone there to take care of that deal. And I was in my hotel room that evening after I'd gone to meet with them. I went back to my hotel room, and I was trying to think of a song like Bring It On Home to Me. And then it came to me, which was You Really Got a Hold on Me. And that's how that song came to be.
Is your songwriting process like that, that you have an idea and then the song just comes out? But first you have like a hook?
Well, not necessarily the hook first, honey. There's no pattern. There is no songwriting pattern. You know, sometimes I'll have some chords that I play on the piano that inspire a song. Sometimes I'll see a billboard or something in a newspaper or something on TV or something that inspires me to have an idea for a song. But I'm not one of those songwriters who needs to take 2 months or 3 months and go off to the mountains and isolate myself so that I can write, or go down to the beach and rent a little hut so I can write. You know, it just happens for me on a daily basis. Almost every day something happens that will inspire a melody or a song to me. And that's just how it's a blessing. I think that everybody has a gift. I think God gives everybody a gift. And so that's the one he gave me. And it's a blessing, and it just happens for me. And like I said, some songs take longer than others, But it's a joy. I mean, it's what I do. It's my life.
Well, this is You Really Got a Hold on Me from 1962, Smokey Robinson from The Miracles. Smokey Robinson will be back in the second half of the show. His new CD of standards is called Timeless Love. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with Smokey Robinson, and David Bianculli reviews Spike Lee's new HBO documentary about Hurricane Katrina. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Smokey Robinson. He has a new CD of standards called Timeless Love. He had Motown's first big hit, Shop Around, and went on to have many more, including You've Really Got a Hold on Me, Mickey's Monkey, The Tracks of My Tears, I Second That Emotion, Tears of a Clown, and this one.
But in the game I lost you, what a price to pay. I'm crying
but I'm only human. You've made mistakes too.
You have such a beautiful falsetto that can be so moving and romantic and or heartbroken and vulnerable. When you started singing in a falsetto and singing in your high voice, did people think it sounded, you know, girlish? Did anyone ever actually make fun of you for it because it was high?
I'm sure people did. Not many people did to my face, but I'm sure behind my back a lot of people did because, you know, by us having a girl in our group, when we used to go places for the first time, people thought that she was the lead singer, you know. But, you know, but see, but I tell you, all my singing idols had those high voices like that. And many guys had them, you know, and that's just the style of singing that I did, and I naturally have a high voice. And when I was even in high school, when I was in the choir and things like that, you know, I sung second soprano, and top alto, so very seldom did I sing a song where I was in the tenor range or anything like that. I just have always had a high voice, and that's my voice. And many people think, well, you know, he's singing in falsetto. Some of the notes that I sing in some of the songs are done in falsetto. But basically, I'm singing in my natural voice because that's just how I sing. When I left the Miracles and I decided that I was going to come back and be a solo artist after about 3 years or so, I dropped my keys down because I wanted to play places where I thought that sound in my voice would not work. I wanted to play the nightclubs that I play now and the casinos and do summer concert series and stuff like that. And I did not think that high voice that I had when I was singing with the Miracles would work in those situations. So I dropped my keys down.
Why didn't you think it would work?
Because it just sounded too kiddie to me. You know, it sounded too young. Mm-hmm. It sounded too like, okay, well, you know, this doesn't fit this particular setting.
You were producing as well as writing and recording at Motown. What did you like about producing other people's records, like The Temptations, for instance?
Well, Terry, I have always enjoyed working with other people and trying to get hits on them. And if I accomplished that, I felt very, very, very good to have a positive effect on one of my brothers and sisters' career, because at Motown, we were all brothers and sisters, and we all hung together. We weren't just artists who saw each other fly by night. You know, I see you in passing. We actually hung out together and did social things together. And, you know, we still have that relationship right today. All of Motown artists who are still here, who are still alive, when we see each other, man, it's just like we saw each other yesterday. We don't have to re-get to know each other and all that stuff like that. We just are brothers and sisters to the end. And it's true with all the Motown people, the writers, the producers and people. When we see each other, it's like, hey, here's my brother or here's my sister. And we have that kind of relationship. So for me to have a positive effect on one of their careers by writing and producing a hit song on them gave me great joy.
You know,
and I know many times people have asked me, like, take a song like My Girl, for instance. People have asked me, well, Smokey, are you sorry that you gave My Girl to the Temptations? No, I'm not. I am very, 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 very happy about that, because it was probably at least one of their biggest records that they ever had in their lives, and it did a wonderful thing for their career. So, man, no, I have never wished that I had kept My Girl for myself or for the Miracles or anything like that, because I'm very happy that it happened for the Temptations.
Why did you give it to them? Did you write it with them in mind?
I wrote My Girl for David Ruffin's voice. I wrote it with the Temptations in mind, of course. Whenever you hear one of my songs by a Motown artist, I have written that song originally for that particular artist, and I had their voice and their sound and them in mind while I was writing it.
Did you come up with lists of, you know, nothing you can do because I'm stuck like glue, you know? No, that's my guy.
that's my guy. That's
my
Mary
girl.
Wells. Wrong Temptations. That was Mary Wells. Yeah, but that song was written for Mary Wells. I mean, I had her in mind. I was working with her at the time. I was producing her records.
Yeah, because you wrote that one too. This is ridiculous.
Yeah, and I had her in mind when I wrote My Guy. Yes. So you weren't too far off, Terry.
You know, I'm going to ask you about Since I Lost My Baby, which is one of my Temptations favorites. Did you write that for the group?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did.
And what aspect of them were you writing it for?
After I did, The Way You Do the Things You Do was the first hit record that I ever wrote for the Temptations. I had been writing a couple of other songs for them when they first came to Motown. And so they were like my assignee group. They had been assigned to me. Barry assigned them to me to try to get a hit on them. So finally I get The Way You Do the Things You Do, which was their first really big hit on them. And I used Eddie Kendricks to sing the lead vocal on that. So all the producers and writers at Motown had access to all of the groups. And we had writing competitions and producing competitions to see who could get the best record on a group. So after I got The Way You Do the Things You Do on the Temptations, all the producers and writers started to write songs that used Eddie Kendricks' voice to sing the lead. But I knew that Paul Williams and David Ruffin were in that group, and they had awesome voices. Everybody in that group could sing individually. But Paul Williams and David Ruffin had voices that I knew once I get a hit on them, it's all over. And so I wrote that song, My Girl, for David Ruffin's voice. And so I continued to write a few songs using David Ruffin's voice. And Since I Lost My Baby was one of those songs. And Since I Lost My Baby was a sort of like a sad song. And I wanted to make this person like My Girl. My Girl was just the opposite of Since I Lost My Baby, because My Girl was saying, even when things are wrong and going very, very bad, you know, there's no sunshine.
Sunshine on a cloudy day, yeah.
I've got sunshine because I got My Girl, you know what I mean? So that was just the opposite of Since I Lost My Baby, because Since I Lost My Baby, everything is going right. But it's not right because I have lost my woman. So that was the opposite of My Girl.
And did you work out the harmonies on this as the producer?
No, because the Temptations were very, 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 very creative in doing their own background vocals. I would be sitting at the piano showing the lead vocal how the song went, with the exception of The Way You Do the Things You Do and another song that I did on the Temptations called I'll Be in Trouble, which I wanted all of them to sing it together to have a harmony sound on it.
Mm-hmm.
With the exception of those two songs, I always let the Temptations make up their own background vocals because they were great at it.
Okay, well, this is The Temptations. The song is written, the record is produced by my guest, Smokey Robinson.
The sun is shining, there's plenty of light.
Oh,
a new day is dawning, sunny and bright.
Oh,
but after I've been crying all night, the sun is cold and the new day seems old. Since I lost my baby.
Since I lost my baby.
Are singing and the children are playing. There's plenty of work and the bosses are paying. Not a sad word should a young heart be saying. But
fun is a bore
and with money a poor. Since I lost my baby.
Since I lost my baby.
My guest is Smokey Robinson. He has a new CD of standards called Timeless Love. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Smokey Robinson. He sings standards on his new CD, Timeless Love. Were you changed a lot by the training that you got at Motown? Did you end up walking differently than you used to? Or, you know, standing differently on stage than you used to?
Well, there was no use to for me, Terry, because, you know, I've been to Motown since the very first day. So there was no use
But
to
you were
me.
Already performing before Motown was even created.
Well, yeah, but I think that, yeah, there was a change in because I was in a group. So then we got professional instructions that they did. I was a lead singer, so I didn't have to worry about that too much, you know. So, but they got professional instruction on doing routines and doing the steps and so on and so forth. In fact, the guy, God bless him, who used to be our choreographer there was a guy named Charlie Atkins. He's passed on a few years ago now. But he was a wonderful man who was a professional dancer himself. He was dancing back in the days of vaudeville and all that, you know. And he was a wonderful dancer, and he taught all the groups the steps and all, you know, Gladys Knight and the Pips, and you see all those steps and the Temptations people. And so he used to say to me, "Boy, I am so glad you are the lead singer because you can't do these steps." I didn't have to worry about that too much. You know, I would fall in every now and then and do something, but it wasn't, you know, something that I had to worry about.
I want to ask you about a period of your life in the mid-80s that you've talked about this and written about this. It was a period when you became addicted to cocaine. How did you start using? I mean, you were already, like, a mature person by then.
Well, I was, honey, but drugs don't know that. Drugs don't discriminate. They don't know or care who you are. And when I go speak, I talk about the drug thing, you know, because, in fact, I'm one of the national spokespersons for the drug graduations for United States. And I speak at drug graduations all the time. And I tell the people there, you know, and see, the myth about drugs is that it always comes from a negative source. It comes from a negative upbringing or you're in a negative situation in your life or you're in some sort of situation where the only alternative or the only out that you had was to do drugs. No. People start to do drugs with their friends. And it's not, you know, it's just your friends have it and they introduce you to it. And because they are your friends, you try it. And many times you like it, and so it can get you strung out.
What fit you about cocaine? You know, people who do drugs tend to find the right drug for them, you know?
Well, you know what, honey? I never really snorted cocaine or did the pipe or anything like that, you know? I was a person, my drug of choice was marijuana, and I liked marijuana. And so I would take the cocaine and put it in the marijuana and smoke it. And that's the only way I ever did it, you know. So I guess because of the fact that I liked the marijuana and the cocaine did a little something different to that was the reason I got off into doing it. But cocaine is a treacherous drug. See, I'd smoked marijuana for years before I even got off into even dealing with cocaine. And cocaine is a treacherous killer drug. And so it kind of strung me out, and I did that for 2.5 years of my life. Now, since May of 1986, I haven't had anything, nor do I want it.
How did you give it up?
I was prayed for, and when I went into that church that evening, now, I have nothing against rehab. You know, I think rehab is a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful place to go for people who are dealing with drugs and all that. But I do think, and I believe, that if you don't get it together spiritually, you're not going to ever conquer it. You know, and when you go to rehab, I've talked to people and I've had people who are close to me, people in my family, been to rehab 15, 20 times. You know, if you don't get it together spiritually, you are never going to conquer it. Okay, so I am once again blessed in this area because I went to a church and a minister prayed for me. And when I walked into the church that night, I was an addict. I hadn't done any drugs before I got there, but when I walked out, I was free. And I mean that. This was in May of 1986. And I've never been to rehab or to the doctor or psychotherapy or any of that. I was prayed and I gave it up to God. And when you give it up to God, it's gone. And
so
that's the way you...
Did that change you? I mean, had you been a regular churchgoer before that? Had you been had you had an active spiritual life before that?
Active. Very active. That's why I say drugs don't care how active you are. You know, and I know, since you're going spiritual here, I'm going to tell you, I am a follower of Jesus Christ. I believe in Christ, and I believe that Christ is my Savior. Okay? Now, I don't try to push Christ on people, because everybody's got their choice there. And the wonderful thing about God is almighty, and God is omnipotent, but he's not a dictator. So we all have a choice. We make our choices in life, and that's what leads us to wherever we get to, you know? So now, I was spiritual long before that happened to me. And I tell people that too. You know, people think that, okay, he went to the church, he got prayed for, he got healed and cured from the drugs, so then he turned to God and turned to, no. I was saved long before that ever happened to me. But we got these choices that we make on our own, and sometimes they lead us in the wrong direction. And when they do, it's your fault.
Let me get back to your music. There's one more song of yours I really want to ask you about, and that's Tracks of My Tears, which is one of your very greatest. What's the story behind this song and how you wrote it?
Tracks of My Tears, like many of the songs that I've written, was introduced to the world by my guitar player, Marv Tarplin. Marv Tarplin does music, and he's not a lyricist, but he does music. He does this wonderful music. So Tracks of My Tears, he had given me the music for the Tracks of My Tears 6 months before I ever came up with an idea for that song. And I had it on tape, and I would listen to it. And the first parts of the Tracks of My Tears that ever came to me was the chorus. Take a good look at my face. You see, my smile looks out of place. If you look closer, it's easier to trace. And I thought that was so good. That tied in so good, but I couldn't think of trace what. And then one day I was in my car, and I thought about, what if a person had cried so much until, if you look closely at them, you could see tracks in their face that the tears had made? And that's how they came to be.
That's really good. And how did you know that this was for you, as opposed to like somebody else that you were producing?
Well, because I just liked singing it myself. Mm-hmm. And so that's how. Yeah.
Okay, well, I think we have to play it. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. This has been a joy.
This is Smokey Robinson. All right. The Tracks of My Tears from 1965. Smokey Robinson has a new CD of standards called Timeless Love. Coming up, David Bianculli reviews Spike Lee's new HBO documentary about Hurricane Katrina. This is Fresh Air. Over the next two nights, HBO is presenting a four-hour documentary by director Spike Lee about Hurricane Katrina. It's called When the Levees Broke, A Requiem in Four Acts. Two acts will be shown each night. All four acts will be shown August 29th, on the anniversary of the day Katrina hit New Orleans. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
When I heard Spike Lee was directing a documentary for HBO about Katrina and how people died and were mistreated and ignored in the aftermath of that 2005 hurricane, my first reaction was to imagine it as a Michael Moore type of film. I saw it as a very personal, angry account, with Spike's voice all over the soundtrack and his face all over the screen. My imagination, it turns out, was all wrong. Spike Lee isn't seen at all. He isn't heard either, except for those few times when he asks a follow-up question of an interview subject while his camera is rolling. When the Levees Broke is an impressively well-structured, well-researched, and fairly presented account of what led to and came after Katrina. It's a wonderful documentary, full of heart and commitment and intelligence and perspective. And it counts as one of Lee's finest career achievements. For one thing, Lee doesn't have to voice his own outrage because there are plenty of others willing to do so. He and his crew made 8 trips to New Orleans and, in total, clocked almost 100 interviews. Some were conducted in the comfort of a studio. Others were done in the field, as in the case of this woman, who stands in front of the remains of her destroyed home and keeps pointing to it for emphasis as she talks about the frustrations of claiming insurance for it.
And now still, here it is 6 months after the storm, and there's still no help. Now I've lost all my, every bit of information that could have proved that I own this home, that I've ever lived here. I had to get duplicate copies of utility bills stating that I had utilities here, that I lived here. I had to go to the clerk of court's office and get whatever information they had to say that I owned this. Then I had to go to an attorney who actually did the sale, and I had to swear out an affidavit that I owned this. Who the hell goes through that? Who goes through that crap? I mean, my God, would I come here and say I owned this if I didn't?
Insurance companies don't come off too well in When the Levees Broke. Neither does FEMA, and neither does the Army Corps of Engineers. But Lee doesn't deny them, or the elected officials, an opportunity to give their side. It's just that, in the wake of all the other evidence in the documentary, their explanations and excuses just don't float. Some of the stuff shown by Lee is straight from TV newscasts, from CNN, NBC, even the BBC. A lot of the rest, though, is handheld video shot by Gulf Coast residents as the storm hit and afterward. This footage can be electrifying, and despite so many other documentaries on Katrina, a lot of it seems new. On the afternoon of August 29th, 2005, the day Katrina hit, a man with his video camera was filming his flooded, abandoned street when another man walked into frame and towards the camera. Lee added some music underneath, but the sound of the wind, like the bad news the man is delivering, is real and powerful.
How you doing, man? I had to leave out of my house, man. I don't know whether that water's coming over that levee or what.
The storm missed us.
I can't hear you.
The storm went east.
So you haven't heard about that water coming over that levee from the lake?
No. Check it out.
Because the water started rising so high in my two-story apartment, I had to get out, man.
Where's that at?
Right across from Lord Robinson overpass.
Okay.
Around Cluid on the Windsor Street.
That Katrina victim may have beaten reporters to the horrible news that New Orleans, though avoiding a direct hit by Katrina, was going to be flooded anyway because of the failure of the levees. The 4 hours of the documentary are divided into themes. Part one chronicles the arrival of the storm, but also puts this disaster into context. Against Hurricane Betsy in 1965, and the intentional flooding of poor white communities to reshape Louisiana in 1927. When some Katrina victims accuse the government of blowing up the levees, a charge Lee includes but does not endorse, the program provides a context full enough to explain why they might suspect that. Part two of the documentary is about the emergency response, or lack of it. That's where the heartbreaks stack up as quickly as the dead bodies. The bodies are shown here, too, but Lee isn't being gratuitous. What's more of a shame? To show these U.S. residents dead and floating in their own homes and streets, or that they were allowed to die there in the first place. CNN anchor Soledad O'Brien tells Lee about coming on a dead body while doing a stand-up report outside the convention center. Then, returning to the same spot 2 days later, finding the same body still there. There are lots of stories like hers, and Lee captures them. The last 2 hours of When the Levees Broke looks at the loss and recovery, and the emotional spectrum is as wide as you'd expect. A woman who lost her 5-year-old daughter in the flood holds a picture of her by the river and cries. A young doctor from Gulfport, Mississippi, traveling home after the hurricane but denied access because Dick Cheney was there on a photo op, gets close enough to the vice president to heckle him, giving him the same rude advice Cheney famously once gave to a colleague on the Senate floor. The doctor's friend captured it on videotape, and it's here too. Spike Lee, the filmmaker, is most evident throughout When the Levees Broke because of his trust in music, in images, and, most of all, in the power of stories told honestly and emotionally by everyday people. It's the best TV documentary of the year so far. And no matter how much you think you know or what you feel about Katrina, you'll find something new here.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. Information at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. From the Cato Charitable Foundation, advancing environmental values and saluting all those who work to sustain our world. And from BMW, where, as an independent company, no ideas are harmed in the making of their cars. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Anthony Shadid of The Washington Post about his experiences in Lebanon covering the war. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of the war in Iraq. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.